Planes powered by GE Aerospace Technology take off every 2 seconds, and nearly 3 billion people flew last year with our technology under wing. As a new independently traded company on the New York Stock Exchange, our purpose remains: invent the future of flight, lift people up, and bring them home safely.
Hurricane Ian strengthens yet again as it heads for the Carolinas. Plus, Chinese service sector activity contracts. And as Russian President Vladimir Putin prepares to formally annex parts of Ukraine, Russians continue fleeing abroad.
This is a pretty significant exodus of people. We're talking about a few hundred thousand. And what's incredible is this is happening all over, from the Arctic Circle, Norway, all the way to the Mongolian steppe.
It's Friday, September 30th. I'm Luke Vargas with the Wall Street Journal. And here's the AM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories moving your world today. Ian, the powerful storm that slammed into Florida on Wednesday has now regained hurricane strength as it heads towards the Carolinas. The National Hurricane Center is warning of life-threatening storm surge along the Carolina coast later today, as well as likely flooding rains across the Carolinas and parts of Virginia. Back in Florida, recovery efforts are underway as officials assess the damage of what Governor Ron DeSantis described as a 500-year flood event. It's not yet clear how many fatalities Ian has caused in the state, with assistance slow to reach hard-hit communities and many roadways flooded or blocked. Russian President Vladimir Putin is scheduled to participate in a ceremony today in which 4 occupied regions of Ukraine will formally be accepted into Russia. Next week, the upper house of Russia's parliament is expected to rubber stamp the annexation of the occupied Ukrainian territories. Wall Street Journal Moscow bureau chief Ann Simmons says that today's moves will set in motion planned changes in the territories, including the distribution of Russian passports and currency, as well as the selection of Kremlin-backed political leaders. All of that could take months to play out as fighting in the territories continues.
This annexation, in many ways, has backed Mr. Putin into a corner, because there really is no turning around from this. Putin is sending a signal that this war is going to grind on for the long haul. It's not going to end soon. Mr. Putin needs to show some kind of tangible victory to his population. And in essence, annexing these regions gives him that victory in many ways. Although, of course, Western nations aren't going to recognize these territories as being part of Russia, and neither is Ukraine. But Mr. Putin has made clear that he doesn't care. He has dared the West to try and stop Russia.
Members of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization and allied countries on Friday said they do not and will never recognize Moscow's claims to sovereign Ukrainian territory. The Eurozone's annual rate of inflation hit double digits in September, with consumer prices 10% higher than a year earlier. That marks the highest inflation rate since records began in 1997. The accelerating rise in consumer prices is likely to prompt the European Central Bank to raise its key interest rate again next month. And new economic data from China's National Bureau of Statistics shows the country's services sector slipping into contraction in September. The retail, catering, and transport industries were hammered as authorities tightened COVID-19 restrictions ahead of a key political gathering next month. It is the latest economic warning sign that has led many economists to slash their China growth forecasts for 2022 and 2023. That slump in the services sector overshadowed a surprise improvement in factory activity, which edged back into expansionary territory in September. India's central bank raised its key interest rate by 0.5 percentage point today, becoming just the latest in a series of central banks to have raised rates recently. So what can India tell us about the situation facing countries around the world? Here with some answers is Wall Street Journal South Asia correspondent Philip Wen. Hey, Philip, thanks for being with us.
Thanks very much.
All right, tell us about the reasons the Reserve Bank of India felt the need to hike rates yet again.
I guess, just like the rest of the world, India is really struggling to curb inflation. In particular, food prices have been stubbornly high in the country, and for a developing country, that makes up a greater proportion of its CPI basket. It's the fourth time it's raised rates since May, when it had a sort of surprise, unscheduled meeting to hike rates, given the sort of global inflationary pressures it's seen from the conflict in Ukraine. Now, what's interesting this time around is that the Reserve Bank of India's governor said that having witnessed the major shocks of the pandemic and the conflict in Ukraine over the past 2.5 years, that the global economy was now in the midst of a third major shock. And this time it's arising from the aggressive monetary policy tightening from advanced economies. And that's having a spillover effect on the rest of the world, including in India and its region.
And Philip, how does this tie into broader challenges the Indian economy may be facing?
Well, to be fair, India's sort of economic imprints of late haven't looked too bad, but that's really because it took such a massive hit when compared to last year, because the lockdown really hit its economy. So a lot of the on paper stronger figures this year have been a result of that just sort of natural rebound from the depths of the pandemic. But in reality, there are still major challenges facing the Indian economy. It's struggling with creating enough jobs for its people. It's got a high unemployment rate and a really low participation rate. So it's really grappling with some really fundamental and systemic issues, even without, as the governor said, this latest shock.
That was Wall Street Journal South Asia correspondent Philip Wen. Philip, thanks for the update.
Not a problem.
Coming up, Russia's borders are swamped as President Vladimir Putin's mobilization of hundreds of thousands of conscripts to fight in Ukraine sends Russians fleeing to neighboring countries. We'll get the latest from one of those countries, Georgia, after the break.
Planes powered by GE Aerospace technology take off every 2 seconds, and nearly 3 billion people flew last year with our technology under wing. By empowering the brightest minds, GE Aerospace is reimagining engine design and advanced aircraft systems, developing hybrid electric engines and technologies compatible with alternative fuels like sustainable aviation fuel. GE Aerospace strives every day to invent the future of flight, lift people up, and bring them home safely.
In the week since Russian President Vladimir Putin ordered a mobilization of some 300,000 conscripts, departing Russians have overwhelmed a chain of ordinarily sleepy border posts stretching across thousands of miles. One country that many Russians are traveling to is Georgia. And Wall Street Journal senior reporter Drew Henshaw has just returned from there and joins us now with the latest. Drew, great to have you. Thanks for the time.
Thanks for having me.
You spent some time at one very busy checkpoint along the Russia-Georgia border. Tell us what you witnessed there.
The Georgia-Russian border, you see this unrelenting stream of young men. They're coming across packed in vehicles. They're carrying bicycles. They've ridden up some of the steepest mountains I've ever seen. They're disheveled. They're hungry. They haven't eaten in days. And they're not really welcome. On the walls right at the border is graffiti that says, expletive Russians and Ruski go home. And there's protesters saying, we don't want you here.
What can you say about the number of Russians entering into Georgia and sort of the demographics of who you saw crossing?
What we've seen is more than 50,000 Russians crossing into Georgia just in the first 5 days after Vladimir Putin announced this mobilization. These are mostly young men. And although they're refugees now in their own country, I met a nuclear physicist. There was a lawyer, lots of lawyers, actually, economists, lots of IT workers, a classical music instructor. These are the educated and the kind of upper professional class that they've lived abroad or they've been abroad. And they know that if they don't leave now, they might never go abroad again. And they're giving up on Russia and they're going into countries that don't really want them there. And they are basically exiles. And it's like something we haven't seen in a way since the 1917 civil war that followed the Russian Revolution. These are the exiles of Putin's government.
Drew, had some of the people you spoke to actually been told they needed to go and report to the war in Ukraine, or were they more preemptively leaving, worried they might get swept up in a broader mobilization maybe in the future?
Exactly. One of the ironies here is that technically the Russian conscription process is supposed to deprioritize the talented, highly educated IT workers, people who do have these kind of higher level skills. But the people who have higher level skills are also the ones who want to go abroad, who don't want to be stuck in Russia behind a bunch of closed borders, and they don't trust their system. They think when it comes down to it, some local official is going to say, I need 1,000 men, I need to hit my quota, and look, there's one right there, I'm giving him his papers. Nobody trusts the system. And so what you have is the kind of educated professional class of Russia leaving, even though in some technical sense, they're the ones who are supposed to be a little bit exempt from this draft.
And Georgia is just one of the countries that Russians are fleeing to. Do we have a sense of the scale of this exodus in total?
This is a pretty significant exodus of people. We're talking about a few hundred thousand that have crossed since this mobilization began. And what's incredible is this is happening all over, I mean, across a chain of border posts that go from the Arctic Circle. Norway has been overwhelmed with a bunch of Russian men crossing at the Arctic border with Russia, all the way to the Mongolian steppe. Mongolia has been completely just swamped with Russians showing up and sleeping in movie theaters and on the streets and in shopping malls. We see it in Georgia, which is a tiny country of a little over 3 million people. And the influx of Russians is really very noticeable there.
Drew, how are Russian authorities responding to this? Are they just letting anyone who wants to leave the country leave?
There's a very intense moment that happens to these Russian men when they're leaving. There's draft stations there where their names are typed into a database to see, has a draft order been mailed to your apartment? And you might not even know that it has. And they type your name in, and if your name is on the list, you get pulled aside. And if it's not, they let you go. But there's so many checkpoints. The traffic goes for literally days because of some of these checkpoints where Russians are saying, if you don't have local license plates, we don't let you in. The best way it was described to me is, at the beginning, it looked like they didn't really have a plan to stop this, and maybe they even were okay with it. If a bunch of people who don't like the war and are traitors to the national Russian cause are leaving, great. That seemed to be the attitude in the first little bit. But as the days progressed, they've obviously cracked down quite a bit, perhaps because they realized that this exodus was a little bit bigger than they anticipated it would be.
Is it notable that countries like Georgia are continuing to welcome in these Russians?
All the countries that border Russia have basically been in this intense debate over whether to welcome these men as a humanitarian gesture and maybe even deprive Russia of troops, or whether actually, sorry, Russians, go home, protest your government if you don't like it, don't come here, you're not welcome, we're busy handling the millions of Ukrainians that your war has unleashed on us. Georgia is in a really particularly difficult position. A fifth of Georgia, don't forget, has been occupied by Russia since 2008. Russia is extremely unpopular in Georgia, but the government is trying its best not to provoke Russia. So you end up in this very complicated situation where Georgian authorities are stuck between the humanitarian imperative to welcome exiles, essentially, combined with the fact that there is no popular goodwill to welcome these Russians, and the geopolitical consideration of not doing anything that would put them in Vladimir Putin's crosshairs.
That was Wall Street Journal senior reporter Drew Henshaw, just back from reporting in Georgia. Drew, thank you so much, as always, for the time.
Thanks for having me on the show.
And finally, after long steering clear of the subject of Bigfoot, a growing number of sober-minded researchers are dipping their toes into the search for the large ape-like animal that's been rumored for centuries to roam the forests of North America. Wall Street Journal reporter Chris Marr says that improved mapping software, database tools, and DNA analysis have made it easier for researchers to apply their expertise to the Sasquatch search.
Some academics are not comfortable being public about their interest in Bigfoot. They don't want their employers to know. I mean, they've worried that they could lose funding for other research projects. Maybe their jobs could even be in jeopardy, or their chances of getting tenure at a university. The way that it's talked about in the Bigfoot circles is that they're in the Bigfoot closet. They are meeting privately, and I spoke to a person who has created this group online called Project Zoobook. Every 2 weeks, getting online and talking about their findings related to Bigfoot. And she says, what happens in Zoobook stays in Zoobook. So they're very careful about their confidentiality and protecting their identities.
All I can say is, having heard the scream of a fisher cat in the woods, who needs the prospect of a Bigfoot to send your spine tingling? And that's what's news for Friday morning. We'll be back tonight with a new show. I'm Luke Vargas with the Wall Street Journal. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening.
Planes powered by GE Aerospace technology take off every 2 seconds, and nearly 3 billion people flew last year with our technology under wing. As a new independently traded company on the New York Stock Exchange, our purpose remains: invent the future of flight, lift people up, and bring them home safely.